A movement towards an economy or capitalism that is actually based on values rather than credit.
They say you can tell the character of a person by the company they keep. And I think you can tell the quality of a teacher by the students they produce. Over the last couple of years, I've met a series of really impressive people, including Justin Brow, Sarah Moran, Mike Boyd, many others, Eddie Harron, just to name one. And these people have a couple of things in common. One, they're all entrepreneurs. Two, they all have a mind that tends towards changing the world. And three, they all had the same teacher. His name's Michael Donovan. He runs a company here in Brisbane called Edgeware. And he's my guest on the show today. I'll let him introduce himself.
My name's Michael Donovan. I run a company called Edgeware Creative Entrepreneurship. I'm an unusual character to find in business education setting. Edgeware's focus is on entrepreneurship and ethical entrepreneurship, I suppose socially aware entrepreneurship. Unusual in the sense that my background is in the arts and community cultural development rather than conventional business pathway. And I'm the loving father of a daughter and the owner of a border collie.
Excellent.
Or the custodian of a border collie, I should say. I don't think you ever own a border collie.
Is that just true with border collies?
It's certainly the case with border collies. It may be with others as well.
It's certainly.
I only have experience with border collies.
It's certainly true from my experience with cats.
Yes, yes. I mean, but cats don't come from this planet, see.
Ah, that explains
cats
a lot.
Are alien creatures. It's the whole idea of ownership, custodianship, or whatever is entirely alien to them. We're here to serve their needs.
I
decide to depart the planet.
I had a cat for 11 or 12 years, had rescued it from a pet store when it was a tiny kitten, and then when my children were born and it wasn't allowed to sleep on the bed anymore, it got up and moved around the corner and moved in with another family of its own volition.
Entirely pragmatic.
Yeah. No loyalty.
But a Machiavellian.
That's right. Explain ethical entrepreneurship for us, Michael.
It's of a piece. I actually have a little bit of problem with definitions of social enterprise and social entrepreneurship for this same reason, in that I think people often, when you talk about ethical entrepreneurship or social entrepreneurship, they think you're talking about essentially a bolt-on to not-for-profit activity. That is, finding new ways for NGOs to run Lamington drives, you know? Whereas I think it actually bespeaks a movement in capitalism, this is taking a very sort of big picture angle, towards what I found interestingly, John Gray just said recently, this is John Gray, the LSE philosopher, not John Gray, the men are from Venus, women are from whatever guy. A movement towards an economy or capitalism that is actually based on values rather than value and values rather than credit.
Now, I don't know about you guys, but I actually wasn't familiar with the John Gray that Michael's talking about, so I went and looked him up for you. This is what I do, save you going and looking him up. His name is John N. Gray, born 1948. He's a prominent British political philosopher and author, formerly school professor of European thought at the London School of Economics. You heard Michael refer to LSE. I thought for a second he said LSD, and I thought we were going down a whole other kind of discussion. But no, it's the London School of Economics. And I've got an excerpt from a debate that this John Gray was involved in earlier in the year, talking about the end of capitalism as we know it. I'm just going to play it for you.
No, it isn't the end of capitalism, and it probably isn't the end of free market capitalism. I think one of the questions you asked, Larry, at the start was, can this be fixed? And in one sense, I think it can't be fixed, because it seems to me that the assumption underlying most of the policies that have been introduced, other than simply to prevent the banking system collapsing precipitately, the underlying assumption has been that a status quo, a condition of normalcy which existed in the past, can be re-established. And I don't think that's possible. I think that the state of affairs that existed in the 20 years that have existed in the 20 years since the fall of the Berlin Wall was extremely abnormal in various ways. It was abnormal in its ideological triumphalism. It was abnormal in its extreme unrealism. It was abnormal in the sense that wholly unrealistic and even utopian ideas were picked up not by the extreme left or by the far right, but by the center. The idea of creating a global free market out of all the different types of capitalism that existed in the world and all the different types of economic systems really was attempts were made to implement it. So I think we're at the fag end now of a particular type of capitalism, the debt-based finance capitalism that has been prevalent in Britain and the United States and some other countries in the last 20 years has really come to an end. And I think one sort of interesting question one should ask is why weren't the warnings that some institutions and some people sent out, as it were, over the last few years, why weren't they heeded? Because there were some warnings. There were one or two academic economists. I say one or two, maybe three or four out of the tens of thousands that there are in the whole world. Attempted to alert the world to the dangers that were being run up in terms of debt and also especially derivatives. There were practitioners of markets, Buffett, Soros, and others. There were people like Nassim Taleb, a hedge fund manager, who several years before the crash not only said that the American banks were sitting on barrels of dynamite, but was fairly specific about what would happen. It is not the case, as one is often told, that a clock will be right twice a day so that people who have been preaching doom will eventually be proved true. These people, Taleb, Rubini, and others, gave specific reasons why we were in difficult circumstances, and so I think actually also did our chairperson tonight, Larry Elliott. These were very specific warnings, and there were warnings even from institutions, the Bank of International Settlements, the IMF, in an occasional moment of lucidity, pointed to some of the dangers that were there, but they weren't heeded. There was talk, nearly ubiquitous talk, and some of it became the basis of action among the safe hands who usually run these things in banks and industries. There was talk of the Great Moderation, the new paradigm, Davos Man, the weightless economy, the long boom. Nonsense from beginning to end. But lots of very sober, grave-looking, reassuringly wooden people accepted it.
You can watch more of that debate up on The Guardian's website, and I'll put a link in the show notes. Now back to our guest, Michael Donovan.
So when we talk about ethical entrepreneurship or social enterprise or whatever, I think we're talking about the kind of business that will be done in an economy that looks like that, a business where the best way to make money is to actually be honest, because people will be looking for the value that that money bespeaks.
It sounds to me like an extension of one of the buzzwords, that we've been hearing in corporate social responsibility programs for the last decade or so, about the triple bottom line.
And there's quadruple bottom lines too, where the fourth value is social cultural.
Right.
I think that's true. I mean, if you check out fourthsector.org, you'll find some examples. They've got a page called sister movements or resident movements or something like that. And it's a bewildering set of links to the technology that is emerging now to describe this phenomenon. I was in a meeting with the Chaos Pilots, this group we're in Denmark a couple of years ago, and sitting around the room with two dozen other people from all corners of the planet, you know, and we actually started using the word movement with a straight face to bespeak this this change that's going on.
I remember when I started the podcast network 4 or 5 years ago and was telling people in the early days that I wanted to make a difference. I wanted it to be a business that, you know, actually made a difference and tried to change the world and make it a better place. I had a lot of my mentors, a lot of people I really respected, both as business people and as human beings, look at me like I was kind of crazy and said, well, you can either change the world or you can make money, but you can't do both. You obviously don't believe that?
No, I don't. I mean, I'm a big fan of Hugh McLeod, gapingvoid.com, you know, and he says he's asked, you like him?
Oh, he's a legend, of course.
Yeah, he says, you know, people ask me, is it about creativity or money or ethics or money? I say it's about effective or ineffective, you know? The slogan that we've come up with Edgeware is make money, have fun, change the world, you know? It's not like you neglect money. I mean, neglecting money is like neglecting cash flow is like neglecting your bloodstream, you know? No bloodstream, no body, no cash flow, no business. You know, the cash flow is what makes it a business. But if you think it's about cash, it's the same as thinking your body is about blood, you know? The blood in your body enables your body to do stuff. The cash in your business enables your business to do stuff. What is that stuff? I mean, what we do at Edgeware is put successful, self-made, usually, entrepreneurs in front of edgies, who are the people that do the program. And I've yet to meet one who says it's all about money, you know. And these are some fairly high net worth individuals. Even when they say, well, you know, it's about providing employment for others or whatever, they are talking about values, whether or not. I think there's a culture in business schools that encourages people to shy away from these terms as necessarily a bit soft and hippie, you know. But I've noticed, it's remarkable to me, that some of the high-end business gurus are now starting to talk like hippies, you know. They're now starting to talk values. And I think that's about predicting what is actually happening in the global economy, as I was discussing before. Value, there's a very short distance between value and value exchange and values and values exchange, you know. So you were hip back then, and Cameron, and now the mainstream's just catching up to you, the parade's catching up to you.
Story of my life, waiting for the world to catch up to me. Mm. Bill Gates is catching up too, my old boss. I know at the Davos conference early last year, he made a speech where he called for creative capitalism, and I've got a line here where he said, we have to find a way to make the aspects of capitalism that serve wealthier people serve poorer people as well. You've been following Mr. Gates's efforts to...
Yeah, and the philanthropists generally. I mean, Gates is still in that model where you make your bundle, then you give it away, you know. And while you're making your bundle, as we all know, you know, you famously squelch a bunch of other people. I think if he was starting now, the whole Microsoft enterprise would probably have looked quite different. It would necessarily have looked quite different because you just can't work that way anymore.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can argue both sides of the Microsoft story because I know thousands of businesses around the world that were successful because of Microsoft's success.
Yeah,
they created a platform for other entrepreneurs to build their business. There was an ecosystem that, you know, supported a whole bunch of entrepreneurs. But, you know, I think that from what I've read with Bill, he's actually trying to suggest that we create a new form of capitalism that thinks more about doing good things and making money at the same time.
Simultaneously, that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think it's in your best interest, even if you're not altruistic or inclined towards compassion, then it simply makes good business sense. You know, we have that to be compassionate, to be responsible. We have this emergent creature called the conscientious consumer now, you know. And this is why our supermarkets are full of the word green and carbon and responsible and, you know, et cetera. These people are not doing it because they're all saints. They're doing it because people are reading the labels now. All of this rhetoric that's been around for a while about people wanting to have conversations with products, people wanting to have relationships with products, is kicking in and starting to turn into real dollars. So at least if you don't make a nod towards some sort of notion of responsibility, then it's bad for business, no matter what business you're in.
I was listening to a speech earlier today, a talk that you gave that was up on YouTube, and that I think our friend Sarah Moran put up. And you were drawing an analogy between people who become entrepreneurs and expect they're going to become as wealthy as a Bill Gates or a Richard Branson,
yes,
to people who decide to become a singer and think they're going to end up as wealthy as Madonna. What kind of expectation do you think people should have when they become an entrepreneur?
Well, this goes to that troika again, make money, have fun, change the world. That is the have fun part of the equation, which is not necessarily jumping up and down and clicking your heels in the air every day, but engaging yourself in something, in a profession that is meaningful. I think people who go into business, in my experience, and this could just be the way that we badge our product and the sort of people that I tend to encounter, are interested in going into business, sometimes because they can't stand the idea of working for other people and they're natural mavericks and et cetera, but usually, even in that case, because the idea of going into business is about achieving the intangibles that they perceive people working in cubes in offices are not achieving. That is, some sense of their life having a purpose and their life having a meaning, and that's a payoff at least as important as a financial payoff. A word that we started to bandy around at the start of this year to describe the edgies, the people that engage with the edgeware process, is weirdo, which I was surprised to see people take up and embrace, you know. Well, sort of reclaiming the word queer. A friend of mine is an organizational psychologist, says edgeware exists to validate weirdness. He puts the number at about 15%. About 15% of a given population will be people for whom this pertains. That is, that they want to live a professional life, they want to live a working life, which is in the same league of meaning to them as their personal life, their personal relationships, their spirituality, their personal development, the sort of the self-actualization that sits on the top of Maslow's pyramid. So for people like that, provided, you know, they're keeping the wolf from the door, paying their rent and so on, the whole idea of business is not about becoming Madonna or Bill Gates or whatever. You know, as somebody said, happiness is not scalable, but a sense of purpose in what it is that they're doing. Now, that doesn't mean they have to be, in the Ashoka Foundation turning around third world, dirty water in the third world or something. It might be running a drive-through laundry. In fact, a drive-through laundry is a good example. A customer of mine in Bundaberg who wanted to develop a drive-through laundry, which on the face of it is a fairly ordinary affair, but then when you scratch the surface and went into it, laundries use a lot of water. She had this whole reticulated water supply system that she'd innovated. She was paneling her roof with solar panels and et cetera, you know? So it doesn't matter, in a sense, what business it is, provided it's not, you know, child slavery or sort of dealing crack. The purpose is what entrepreneurs, in my experience, are actually after. I think that accounts for, you know, as we were mentioning before, where Bill Gates is. I really don't think, I mean, the money's nice, of course, but as I said, you know, happiness is not scalable. Bill is not going to see a million more sunsets than me just because he has a billion times more money than I do.
Well, he might do. He might, you know, be on the early adopters program for some, you know, new life extension program that only billionaires can afford. I really relate to what you're talking about, a sense of meaning. I mean, for me, when I jumped out of the corporate scene and started my own business, that's really what I was chasing. It was a sense of meaning. I found it incredibly depressing sitting in a cubicle day after day, week after week, month after month, moving papers from, you know, the left-hand tray to the right-hand tray, effectively.
That's right. Yeah. And, I mean, a big cohort of edgies is actually 40, 50-somethings who have got to a point in their life where that's suddenly come home to them. You know, that might be a health scare, might be somebody they know who's carked it because of, you know, heart condition that's been brought about because of all that stress or whatever. But what I find inspiring is a larger cohort, an increasing cohort of edgies from the 20-something bracket who once upon a time might have been expected to be into, you know, sex and drugs and rock and roll, and probably still are, but by this whole idea of corporate social responsibility, ethical practice in their business. That is, I think this is a movement. To use that word again, I think we're seeing the emergence of new kinds of capitalists who are populating this field of capitalism with a human face.
A friend of mine, Dr. Peter Elliard, down in Melbourne, who's you know of Peter?
I know of Peter, yeah.
I published his most recent book called Designing 2050, which I'll have to get you a copy of. But Peter is very fond of this term planetists. And he's talking about the rise of this movement where we're all starting to identify not with a city or a nation, but with the planet and the well-being of the planet, which brings upon a sense of responsibility for the welfare of the people of the planet, not just, you know, the people who look like us or the people who live in our suburb.
Yeah.
Do you think that's something that's being driven by something to do with the middle class? Do you think this is a trend that is only happening in Western countries where people are thinking about ethical capitalism, or is it also happening in developing countries?
I can't talk too much about developing countries because I think it's a different mix there, and I'd like to come back to that. In developed countries, yes, I think it's an evolutionary thing. If you look at the way in Western cultures, in recent history, really, from only the last 400 or 500 years, the city state and then the nation state emerged as an economic force. So you could, one way of understanding this is understanding it as part of the evolution of capitalism. That is, that the nation state became a very efficient vehicle for organizing labor and organizing the exchange of goods and services. Now, in a globalized economy with ubiquitous computing, or almost ubiquitous computing, and again, I'm just talking about the West here, the need for a nation state is less pressing in the capitalist system at large, and we're finding this in the two sort of ends of the spectrum, I suppose, laissez-faire economic small government and so on in the United States, where you have this awful emergence of the working poor and terrible health and all of that. And on the other end of the spectrum, the social democracies of Scandinavia, where big government and socialist-style provision of services to the population, health, welfare, transport, housing, justice, etc., are increasingly less affordable because, you know, the rich can take their money offshore. The tax base for the democratic socialist sort of nation state is being eroded, which brings me to the sort of emerging world, and particularly, say, the interface in the East that we're seeing. I think there's a new kind of organization emerging. You know, take Singapore, for example, where the Singapore government Singtel, one of the biggest comms companies in the world, and Singapore Airlines have essentially become the same entity. You know, so where does the Singapore nation state end and Singapore Airlines, a large multinational company, begin? I think there's a weaker and weaker argument for the existence of nation states at large in the West.
So take me through the Edgeware program. How do you? I mean, you're not a university, are you? You're not a business school in traditional style.
Not in a traditional sense. Its roots are in. Well, there's three main influences. The one has to do with my own background in community cultural development, which is, you know, as they say, it's not giving people fish and it's not even teaching people to fish anymore. It's about revolutionizing the fishing industry. It's about remaking and remodeling economic constructions so that people can get what they want out of life. So that's community cultural development, or the French have a nice term for it, animation socioculturelle, social cultural animation. So the animation of latent potential within a company or within a city or within a tribe or group. The second strand is probably the influence of Denmark's Chaos Pilot School, which is about 15 years old now, which is a kind of, relative to Edgeware, much more a kind of alternative business school, which incorporates, you know, playfulness, ethical practice and so on into what it is that it does. It's so-called corporate DNA, and I continue to work with them. I'll be over there in October this year. And the third influence is the impact on me, or the influence on me, of working for more than 20 years now with Indigenous Australian people and their cultures, and coming to some understanding, as far as it's possible for me, of how the hunter-gatherer world works, not only the social, cultural, but spiritual, economic, and political nature of that world, which many would argue is closer to what it is to be human in many respects, because we were all hunter-gatherers at one stage, right? It's only this last 5,000 years that we've been stewing in our own juices in things called cities. So, you know, there are important, particularly pedagogical insights that I've derived from interacting with Indigenous cultures. For example, the importance and the privileging of tacit knowledge transfer as distinct from explicit knowledge transfer. That is, education which occurs in situ, that occurs when you actually put masters and apprentices together. You know, you want to learn how to hunt, you don't buy a book called Hunting 101. You find somebody who's a bloody good hunter and you get next to them. And Aboriginal people would say you keep your eyes open and your mouth shut. Again, nothing particularly new in this. We have it in the Western tradition, in the atelier tradition, the apprenticeship tradition, and so on. But Indigenous Australian culture in particular really cuts things back to what works. You know, like if you're a nomad, you only carry what it is that you need. There's no sense carrying stuff that's too heavy for too far. And I think that extends to the conceptual as well as the physical. You only carry the ideas that work. You only carry the ideas that get you where you want to go. So it's a tactical rather than a strategic orientation. It's about short-term solutions of problems in a more or less complete way to enable you to actually move on to the next place, rather than a kind of, John Gray would call it utopian view of continual progress to a point of some kind of perfection, which is a legacy of, in the West again, I'm just talking about the West, of our Judeo-Christian or Greco-Judeo-Christian DNA, and more recently, post-Enlightenment, our humanistic DNA, which again constructs Homo sapiens at the top of a heap, which group eventually becomes perfect, whether that's the perfect worker or the Aryan nation or the communist putty-coloured ideal, you know. Aboriginal people then and now just want to solve problems, survive, get through to the next day and hold things more or less intact, and they do what's necessary to do to achieve that. So you put those three together, the chaos pilots of Scandinavian business school coming out of the sort of rich social democratic tradition of Scandinavia, the indigenous culture I was just talking about, and this idea of social cultural animation. It makes for an entity in Edgware that looks like a school sometimes, looks like an incubator sometimes, looks like a learning circle or professional or adult education network. And it, in fact, is all of those things. Now, the strength of that is that, you know, it's novel, and it gets some traction because it doesn't quite... It differentiates itself from other elements of a very crowded training working place, and it's the downside, too. Because it's novel, it doesn't fit neatly into any one place. It doesn't fit into the incubator discourse neatly. It doesn't fit into... higher education or adult education neatly, and it's not really a service club like the Rotary Club is either. But it has a bit of all of those.
So how do people get involved with Edgware? Do they apply any time during the year? Can they slot in, or is it, do you run on a term basis?
Well, Edgware's 3 years old, so we're only talking about something that's very new, and it's evolving all the time. At the moment, our core product is a course called Build Your Business. People join up for those in groups of 10 or 15. We have a partnership with a TAFE Institute, which allows us to deliver accredited vocational education training modules as part of that. The strategy for which is really an economic one as much as an educational one, that is the subsidies available through for people to do what we do through our relationship with the TAFE. But what happens and what we're building on now really spins off from that, which is that once you get a group of weirdos together, they recognize each other. And we've had personal relationships, business relationships come out of these programs, you know. So in a sense... the course is a kind of excuse for relationship making. So Edges got together for the purpose of the course, but I mean, the joke somebody made is that Edgware is like a dating agency for entrepreneurs, you know? That is, the single most common piece of feedback we get from Edges is that, yes, they really appreciate what we offer. We have this suite of tools that we call the small business backpack that they learn to use, a set of simpler business decision-making tools. But what we really, this is then, that what we really got from it is each other. And there's clues in there for how to actually develop Edgware further. So there's ideas cropping up right now. And interestingly, at the three-year point, which is one of these sort of magical numbers, I call them, that seem to crop up in business all the time, At 3 years, Edgware is now looking at developing what is our customers themselves are telling us we should be developing. So coaching services, for example, a coaching bureau for people that are already traveling well with their business and don't have time to attend courses anymore. Possibly even a kind of a special kind of social networking presence in the web that's a bit like LinkedIn, but with a more Edgware kind of style, flavour and purpose. Possibly the idea of a place where you can go to have a beer or a coffee and meet clients, but also do a class and possibly have a massage. Because, again, that have fun part is about wellness, right? It's about... that sense of purpose in your life and so on, and that's also about looking after your physical body as well as your professional body. So there's no shortage of ideas emerging. It's just a question of which ones to do when and which ones to invest in. I'm very optimistic about it. The feedback is very good.
Let me ask you about capitalism on a higher level. You know, I've come to the conclusion over the last few years that the capitalist experiment that, you know, started in its modern form in the United States a couple of hundred years ago has done a lot of damage around the world. And we're starting to see the full effects of that in the damage to our environment and the way that's impacting the survival of not only our species but of many species around the planet. Do you think, broadly speaking, that capitalism is morally justifiable moving forwards?
Well, I don't think it's one thing for a start, and you see this in the literature. You know, people talk about Fordist capitalism versus late capitalism or even post-capitalism. I think the principle of formalized markets and formalized arrangements of labor to suit those markets that emerged really post-Enlightenment are clearly built for a kind of production-consumption cycle that Marx identified, which is over, you know, or which is becoming eroded by the emergence of globalized economies precipitated by ubiquitous computing and global markets and etc. So that's the first thing to say, I think. It's not one thing, you know. It's like with Blythe China's place or India, it just was one place. These are categories that make for a certain kind of shorthand in conversation but aren't necessarily reflecting what's going on. It may be that in the instance I gave before of the Singapore government conflating with Singtel and Singapore Airlines that a kind of post-nation state political economic form is emerging now that we can't pick because by nature it's novel. We haven't had any experience of that, which is this planetist, globalized means of exchange. Having said that, you know, I mean, we're just at the tail end of the failure of the 100-year experiment in socialism, you know, unless you're ready to say that North Korea is a socialist state. When Fidel goes, it's all over, you know, it hasn't worked. So the main alternative for capitalist political economic organization seems to have fallen over, and that's what we're left with. So just being very pragmatic about it, this is what we have to work with. Maybe you've got some ideas about what the new global form of political economy might be, but for me it still resides in the broad template that was set down post-Enlightenment.
Yeah, well, we could go on a discussion of anarcho-syndicalism with, you know, merged with a form of ethical capitalism, but that's going to take us into a whole new show, I think. We might do that
That
another time. I guess I want to finish up by talking about, for people out there who are still working in a corporate job and feel inside them that they think they could be doing more, what kind of advice you give to people when they're trying to make that leap from corporate dependency, wage slavery, to the world of being an entrepreneur, which can seem quite scary and threatening when you're in the confines of the corporate womb? What kind of things do you have to say to people like that?
Well, it is scary, you know. I mean, because it involves risk by nature. And the trouble with working in the corporate womb is that you actually become very risk averse, and particularly if you climb the slippery ladder, the slippery pole, you become more and more risk averse because that's not, you know, taking risks is not the way you advance in those systems. I think one of the reasons Edgeway's working out is that it, as I say, it brings together weirdos. It validates weirdness. You know, it's weird if you're sitting in Cubeville to have these thoughts, if I was to venture advice, I would say find somebody who's having the same thoughts, because and sit down, have coffee with them. Find three or four others, sit down, have coffee with them, and things start to happen out of that, you know. And I can say this from first-hand experience. People start to validate each other, validate these weird thoughts, validate these maverick intuitions that they're feeling, and feel that they're not quite so alone. I think we're evolved as monkeys. If we actually see other members of the troop starting to behave in a particular way, you know, like washing the sweet potatoes in the 100th monkey story, we start to think, well, maybe we can actually do it, you know. Sometimes that's the report that I get from edgies, that I've been thinking about this for years, but now this has just given me the imperative to make the jump, you know. Goethe said boldness has genius in it, you know. So it's really a psychological state. They typically have the business idea, they have what they want to do, they need reinforcement from others that it's okay to do that. They just need that validation. So find some others, rather than think that you're out there on a limb by yourself, needing to solve all your problems by yourself. There is somebody out there who's been there and done that, and if you actually call them and ask them for a coffee, they'll probably say yes.
You know, I think the corporate system is designed to fit people into preset holes, and you, if you don't fit into that hole or that mold, yeah, my experience was you definitely do feel like you're a weirdo and a crazy. I certainly felt like that when I was working at companies like Microsoft. I felt like I was the weirdo, and you know, if you spend too much time in those places, you can actually get to a point where you start thinking they're right. And I remember after I left Microsoft, traveling around Europe, taking a couple of months off to clear my brain, and listening to an audio book by Tom Peters that came out in sort of 2003, 2004. And he was actually, one of the things he was talking about was one of the big challenges he felt for corporations over the course of the next decade was figuring out ways to keep those creative weirdos inside the company and not shunning them so they go and start up your competition.
Yeah. Yeah. The trouble is that often begs questions about the shape of the corporate shape itself, you know, because not only do you have to tolerate those people, you have to reward them, because otherwise they'll just rack off and do their own thing, you know, that's their nature.
Yeah.
So how is it that you're not, and that's an attitude towards risk, which particularly in this country with our very poor risk orientation and R&D orientation is a real issue. So sometimes it actually involves rethinking the structure of the company itself. And, of course, that can be profoundly threatening to the gatekeepers and the people who have a vested interest in keeping it the shape that it's in. I think that's right. It's cultural change, ultimately, you know. It's like the proposition to somebody who's trapped in a paradigm of understanding that Indigenous people are somehow, you know, not intelligent or don't feel pain. That this is actually, you know, rubbish. This can be a profoundly threatening proposition for some people. Nevertheless, you know, welcome to the 21st century.
And, you know, I think the best testimonial I can make for what you're doing, you must be doing something right, because over the last few years, before I'd even heard of you by name or before I'd even heard of Edgeware, and before I moved to Brisbane even, you know, I was meeting a range of really impressive people that I have since found out all tie back to you. It's just been crazy over the last 6 months where I've been talking with really, you know, fascinating, bright, innovative, creative people, and Michael Donovan or Edgeware ends up coming up in the conversation. I was like, what the hell's going on here? It's like a cult that no one told me about, you know?
It is actually a little bit like that, and that's something we've got to be very careful about, not least because we have the precedent of the Chaos Pilots, which was started up by a guy called Ulfa Elbeck, and became, in my view, way too focused on that individual. I think getting in the helicopter and taking that wider view is important, Cameron. What we're talking about is something that's not unique to any one person or to any one group or company. We're talking about a mimetic evolution of capitalism here.
Mm-hmm.
And some of us might be slightly closer to the front end of that, or shaping a better surfboard for that wave than others. But it's a wave, it's the wave that counts, you know.
Well, I agree. I do think this is a wave that's coming, and you know, sometimes when these waves are coming, we need people to help interpret the wave and understand it and create frameworks and platforms for us to leverage the wave more effectively than we might on our own. So I think it's very important work. And, you know, I was very excited to hear about you and what you're doing as somebody who has felt quite lonely at times out there over the last 4 or 5 years, pushing this idea of changing the world and making enough money to keep the business running at the same time, which I haven't done a very good job of, either of those, I would say. But the vision has been there, so it's great to know that there are other people.
Could you be doing anything else, Cameron, you know? I mean, could you go back to working for Microsoft or the corporates anymore? You know?
Well, I might have to, Michael, and that's the interesting thing. You know, when I left the corporates to start this, and a lot of my friends said, well, wow, I mean, what, you know, I sold my house and sunk all of my money into it and sold my shares and sunk all of my money into it. And a lot of people were saying, well, what if it fails?
Mm.
And my response was always, well, you know, if it doesn't succeed, I'll have a great experience and I'll just go back into the workforce. I'll do something else.
Yeah.
And, you know, the business is at a point now where it's been hasn't been making money for the last 6 months. It made money for a while, but then the global financial crisis hit, yeah, you know, podcasting advertising quite hard. And it's, yeah, you know, I've been going through the process for the last couple of months of thinking about, okay, well, what do I do now? Do I
join Edgeware, of course?
Well, absolutely. I'm very excited.
Well, you're de facto doing that anyway. You're de facto mixing with it. Maybe you need to develop a new sense of urgency about your business. I mean, when we're talking about Edgeware as a place, you know, one of the titles I have, you know, in sort of, I see it in Ionic, suspended above Ionic columns out the front, you know, is the Edgeware House of Urgency. I think every now and then we've got to create a bit of sense of drama about our business and create some focus and some pressure. And the Chaos Pilots have this notion of coal to diamonds, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Let's create a bit of urgency, a little bit of pressure around the business. There's nothing like a, you know, a bit of a credit squeeze or a cash flow squeeze to do that, of course. But from what little I know about your business, there's about 16 different things that you can do with it, you know. And the question arises for me, not knowing it well enough yet, is are you doing the right ones in the right order?
Well, I would guess not, if the lack of results has anything to do with it. You know, and I think that's one of the interesting things as an entrepreneur. It can be quite lonely, particularly in the hard times when
absolutely,
when a business model that, you know, you were focused on for a few years has gone belly up and you have to rethink, yep, and restructure and doing that with no cash and all of the pressures that, yep, come with no cash flow. It's, you know, it sounds like a good idea to have a place you can go to where there's other creative minds that can support you.
Absolutely. And that's where it really starts to count. That's called resilience, you know. And, I mean, as the Chinese proverb says, you know, the story about catastrophe and opportunity, there's gaps in there. The question is seeing them.
Yeah, I agree. And one of my favorite sayings over the last 3 or 4 years has been that the questions that you ask yourself determine your reality.
That's right.
And I think when you're going through tough times, it's really important that you ask yourself the right questions. You have to program, yeah, your brain in the right way to be thinking about, how do I turn this into an opportunity, not, yeah, oh my God, how could this happen to me, and et cetera,
yeah,
et cetera. Well, Michael, listen, I'll let you go, but it's I want to thank you for your time. I've been really looking forward to having a chance to chat with you in some depth, and very excited about what you're doing, and look forward to getting more involved and hearing more of the Edgeware story.
Yeah, real pleasure to talk to you, Cameron.
Well, that's another show. Thanks for listening, folks. Don't forget, TPN, independent media, we need your support. If you want to keep this kind of independent media on the air, go to tpn.thepodcastnetwork.com or to g'dayworld.com. See the link to the TPN 500. Sign up. Become a supporter of the network. $20 a month. You get all the free media you can eat, and you keep it on the air, which is the important thing in this new era. If we want an independent media, we've got to be prepared to flop out a few bucks for it. $5 a week, cost of a cup of coffee. And don't forget the G'day World live show, Tuesday night, 8 p.m. Australian Easter time. Go to g'dayworld.com/live for all the details. Come on and join in the chat. We'll be talking politics, religion, social activism, history a little bit, and sometimes we have a guest too. But it's mostly just a chance for me to connect with you and for us to have a free chat. By the way, the background track that I've got playing today is called Sala. It's from the album Afterquake by Abigail Washburn and the Shanghai Restoration Project. It's raising money for the victims of the earthquake in China. So check that out. See the link on g'dayworld.com. Don't forget, do something important with your life, folks. This is Cameron. Out. Salah, 水